G'day, listeners. You're listening to the Natives Rouse About podcast. I'm your host, Michael, and today ANA National Governor Matthew Grant will be joining me, as well as Victoria Governor Thomas, to discuss our national AGM that's just been, as well as the recent election bloodbath. So, how are you going, boys?
Yeah, good.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, nice. Okay, let's jump into it. So, one very short listener comment Amanda Cohen said about our Eureka Stockade podcast. Very informative. I'm born in Ballarat from convict stock. Great show. Thank you. So nice to have a bit of positive feedback there. Thanks for that comment. why don't we just jump into it today? So I've picked out a short poem that we can go through as customary, and then we might go straight into the election. So this one is Nationality by Mary Gilmore, 1942. I have grown past hate and bitterness. I see the world as one. Yet, though I can no longer hate, my son is still my son. All men at God's round table sit, and all men must be fed. But this loaf in my hand, this loaf is my son's bread. That was Nationality by Mary Gilmore, which I think fits the sort of attitude of the association quite well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there's a good it's a perfect way of summarizing the moral lesson there. And I mean, this even throws to broader ideas of ethno-nationalism versus just kind of lowbrow bigotry or I don't know, lack of a better word, this kind of vilifying racism, which is not really what we believe in, that you can be completely morally and reasonably consistent by saying you believe in a white Australia and the advancement of your own welfare, of your own people and your children, while at the same time not actually just hating everyone else who's not a member of your kin. And I think this is true. Like, this is the true Australian position historically. Like, even at the height of the White Australia policy, there were always some foreign elements here for business reasons, and they were treated with great respect and dignity, really. And so there's, that is the, I suppose, the historical Australian model of ethno-nationalism, fits in with what Mary's saying here.
Yeah, I think it's important because some people will say that you need to base everything on hate, and you need that sort of I guess emotional boost to engage in the struggle. But I really think it's a very limited approach. And whenever you see the people might have dropped out of nationalism or sort of rejected the nationalist worldview, it's probably because they started off with this foundation of just hate and bitterness. And then they have this experience of I met this one black guy, and he was nice to me, and he had a beer with me, and we had a chat, and I realized that all these people aren't evil and cruel and vicious or whatever. So you can't just base yourself upon hate. I think you have to base yourself on this. Well, my son is my son, and my son, I may care for other people, just out of basic human decency, but this loaf, this land, I guess if we extend the metaphor, this is my son's. So I obviously don't want that to be taken away.
Yeah, and I think if you were to look at it objectively, if you think otherwise, if you think that other people's sons are worth more than yours, you're either lying or you need to get yourself checked out. There's something wrong with you.
Yeah,
Indeed.
just a good, sensible nationalist, no homo, but sensible nationalist approach, not to get into UK politics and the scene over there. Let the listener understand if they know. all right, election discussion. So the first thing I've got on the plan is Dutton, sacrificial potato, question mark. Yeah, so not really a sacrificial lamb, but what do you think? Did the Liberals go into this really thinking that they were going to win?
I think that they expected to win by default because of the absolutely abysmal first term that Albanese had. And I think they can be, to some extent, forgiven for thinking that. But the way that they completely mangled this election, it was just completely pathetic. They, you know, Dutton is a weird looking guy. He looks weird. He acts weird. He's just completely non-relatable. People don't like him instinctively. There's just something wrong with him. To the point where Albanese, even though he just messed up everything that he touched in his first term, people still preferred him. Absurd.
Yeah, I mean, Albanese performed well in the debates as well. Like, that's the other thing. It was so, it, like, Dutton did so bad that Albanese came off looking level-headed and sensible, like he's grown up, which
Crazy.
was shocking. But Dutton was always unelectable, man. You hit the nail on the head. He is just a weird guy. And the other thing with that, like, I think after the last election, the Liberals got smashed so hard. I think that Dutton was the only man in the room that really had the, not necessarily the moral authority, but I suppose a sense of respect and authority in the party room that he was able to keep the party, I suppose, together or unified. Perhaps other potential leaders would have got turfed or would have been, there would have been maybe more internal factional drama, which Dutton actually managed to avoid. Despite him being unelectable to the nation generally, he may have actually succeeded in keeping together a Liberal Party which had just suffered an immense catastrophic defeat after ScoMo, you know.
For what purpose, though? Because, you know, if you can't get elected and you lose an election following up this hard, for what
Yeah.
purpose was all of
Yeah,
that?
of
What
course,
purpose
of course. Yeah.
was selling out all of your base from cucking endlessly, social signaling with Indians and everyone else? What was the point of all of that? Unless you
Obviously
were.
they thought they were going to win. Like they
Yeah.
were going hard. The interesting thing about this election is just the primary votes. It was so, you know, it's the media is making it out to be a Labor landslide victory in a kind of dishonest way. They have absolutely smashed the House of Representatives, and they're going to get an enormous majority, like a majority that hasn't been seen in quite a long time. But statistically, only around 34.5% of people in this country put Labor as their first preference. So the vast majority of voters in this country did not want Labor to rule.
To call this a mandate, as I've heard some
Yeah,
people say,
exactly.
is absurd.
They have
Yeah, there's
no
always
popular mandate.
a lot of spin. Like, you know, as soon as the results came out, you had the ABC putting out these things like, you know, this proves that Dutton's hard right Trumpist turn was like rejected by the Australian people, who are sensible, good, decent Aussies. They don't want any of that. Just like complete brain dead, self-serving analysis. And a lot of the analysis, I think, at the end of the day, is completely self-serving, depending on the like the factional position of the person doing it. But really, I mean, the Liberals, as we know, are kind of between a rock and a hard place, because they still want to occupy this right conservative space. But they're kind of having to drift constantly to the left and appease, you know, mass migration and all these other things. So, Yeah,
not
but
that
at
they
that
picked up
point,
any of the, like, are not, they didn't do very well with, you know, Indians and Chinese and all that. So.
no. And at that point, like, why would anyone want to be involved with the Liberal Party? You know, if you want to be a leftist, go be a leftist. If you want to be, you know, a non-white grievance politics affiliated person, then just go and do that with your own party. You know, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean,
Well,
Tony
what is
Abbott's
the point
calling
of
it.
Liberal Party at this point? I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, so-called base tones is calling it the party of immigrants now. So they're really they don't stand for anything Australian anymore. It's just global capital.
That's all right. Look, you're kind of right. Labor, I mean, which party brought in the neoliberal economic policies in the first place? It was Labor. So, like, we're kind of retreading old ground here. But I mean, does this result prove the accelerationists right then, that we should be aiming to polarize the system as much as possible? After all, it seems at least one half of the center is kind of collapsing. So what do we reckon there?
I think that has some nuance. So yes and no. I think to some extent I do believe in the theory that a strong conservative party does restrict the growth of the real right, as long as they're well put together and organized and relatively popular. There is a strong cordon sanitaire involved. But there is also another side to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would say to it generally, yeah, you're right that having a reasonably competent kind of populist, patriotic kind of option is a pacifier or a pressure release valve for like legitimate nationalism. In terms of this proving the accelerationists right, I mean, I always had mixed feelings about the accelerationist theory, and when COVID happened, it was totally debunked in my mind. I mean, that there is almost no level of tyranny that you can put people through that they won't just succumb to, so long as there is food on the table. And the system has so much more to give before there's no longer food on the table. In reality, I think the game which we should be thinking about, slowing. I guess it depends on what we're talking about, acceleration on like a societal scale. We want to retain law and order for as long as we can, so we can actually organize ourselves to be able to survive the the inevitable collapse of the state. That's my general point of view on it. In terms of the accelerating the destruction of conservative politics, yeah, terrific. I do think that this chasing the centrist vote means chasing Asia because, by mere demographic shift, they are going to be the central vote, and so that is bad. We need to polarize the political debate as soon as possible, so that people are actually getting an open vote on the immigration issue. The only final thing I would kind of add to the election commentary, which I think is so funny, is how badly the Greens have suffered. But if you look at their electorates, they're some of the most ethnically diverse places in the world, and they have literally they have in, they've imported so many coloured people that they've actually lost their seats because coloured people won't even vote for the Greens. They're that gay. So,
Wonderful.
yeah.
Based Asian conservatives,
Yeah, I mean, it's like it was like
winning.
the yes no referendum, you
Boomer
know.
Sivnats
If
proved
it, if if
correct.
if if it wasn't for all the ethnics in Western Sydney, we would have a voice to Parliament right now, just think about it.
Well, if you look at the garden,
Sad
it's
stuff.
because the Greens were not nice to Jews, and I don't know if that's meant to be a pro-Jew or an anti-Jew statement.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be. It's it
Well,
could be a totally neutral statement, but revealing of the facts of the power balance of that class of people.
indeed, indeed. Well, I think one thing this does show is that infiltrating the Liberal Party is probably not the way to go. Just because why kind of jump on board a sinking ship and start trying to patch holes when I think we'd be better off served to let the ship sink and hopefully we'll be able to build an option to replace it, or at least something genuine that actually represents Australian nationalism. And obviously there are a few parties that I guess had a go at an alternative like the Rennick thing, but that was probably jumping in a bit too fresh. Even though he was a sitting senator, he just I don't think he had the logistical background in place yet to make that work, but we'll see what happens with that. But if we're not doing electoral politics, then perhaps we should be doing building community organizations like the ANA. So let's go to our other main topic, which is the recent national AGM for the association, and a little bit of a debrief of that one and how it went and some of the speech topics. So how do we feel that this one went, guys? Because this was my first one, so I really have nothing to compare it with.
Yeah, no, I thought it was an exceptional event, definitely our best one yet. They all have their own quirks, and the nostalgia of our old ones we held years ago, back in the 2020, early 2020s, still holds dear to me. But yeah, this was an exceptional event, and it was so great to have new members from across the country come out and get to meet everyone from the different branches and just have a great merry time on top of the real practical side of what we were doing. But what did you think, Tom?
Yeah, really good. It was really, really good. Lots of intelligent, hardworking people from all across the country. Had some really good conversations, both political and non-political in nature. A lot of really driven people to try and make our people and our culture but as good as possible. To drive forward as much as possible.
Yeah, I thought one of the really good things about it, and I know it hasn't been known in the past, but this might be of interest to listeners, is that this is the first national AGM where we had associate members come. So even people who aren't part of a fully set up branch, they were able to come and meet people and see how we run things and get inspired. And I know there's a lot of potential for at least, two more branches, I reckon, will be popping up soon, but we'll see how that goes. I know a national secretary always tells me, don't announce anything too soon. Don't announce anything too soon. But I'm very optimistic about that. So I'm just more of a white pillar, I guess, when it comes to that. But definitely was seeing a lot of the growth with the different people rocking up. Do you want to make perhaps mention why we picked Ballarat, Tom?
Yeah, so Ballarat, as many of our listeners would know, has an immense importance to us as Australians, not just as Victorians, but as the center of the Eureka Rebellion or the Eureka Uprising, as well as kind of Ballarat and the Goldfields area being sort of the nucleus of the Victorian state as it ended up becoming one of the most powerful and wealthy and active parts of the Australian Commonwealth. And there's a lot of excellent buildings there with a lot of great history. It's a much more Australian city than Melbourne, so it was much more pleasant to be around in.
Yeah, nice. And I thought it was very professional with the venue. Obviously, we don't want to go into too many details, but yeah, it looked great with the podium and the stage and all that. I thought it was fantastic, and we're really starting to get there with the professionalism, which is wonderful to see. So the one of the first things that happened was the update from our national governor. So obviously, you can't give the full update because there are a lot of things in the background. Initiatives that we get involved in and people we work with that we can't disclose to the public, at least not yet. But of those more public-facing things, is there, what do you want to say to our listeners, Grant?
Oh, look, we just gave a rundown of our organizational strategy for the next few years and just some of the main projects we're working on, which at a high level are things like our property investment syndicate. And building up our legal resources in the association, on top of a few other things that we've been working on. Just to throw back really quickly to what some people would call a bad election, or particularly the young liberal nerds would call it a bad election. This is why we're hyper focused on meta politics and acknowledging that. Success in electoral politics has to be downstream from building meta-political infrastructure and resources which can support legitimate nationalist politics and political actors. And so this is a big part of what we do, and what we're focused on is building up that kind of secure, anti-fragile institution which can not only take care of our people in raw kind of material terms, but also be that kind of bedrock institution from which political efforts can come in their due time.
Yeah, excellent. Wonderful. And then Thomas, you also gave an interesting speech on intentional communities, which is something that is on the radar for us, perhaps a few years down the track. But what examples did you look at, and what can we maybe take away from those?
Yeah, so the three main organizations I looked at were Orania, South Africa, the Woodlander Initiative in the UK, and the Return to the Land Movement in the US, and the various pros, cons, interesting parts about those movements and syndicates, and essentially how desirable some sort of intentional community would be for us in Australia at this point in time. The conclusion was that essentially right now it would be a very difficult thing to do, to the point where resources that could be used to put towards that would be better used in other areas. But it is something which is definitely interesting for the future and something that may be necessary.
Yeah, very good. And some people might criticize the intentional community thing by calling it white flight and sort of just kicking the can down the road. But on the other hand, we've had this sort of emerging term of white fortressing, sort of building sort of a power base in different areas where we can develop our movement and develop businesses and other things that will be able to fulfill that more logistics role that that Grant you talked about. So would you agree, Grant, that this will be a good direction to go in the future?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's merit to a lot of different strategies, and strategies I think realistically need to focus on logistics as their first priority, because as anyone who's been around in nationalist politics for any considerable amount of time will tell you, the greatest burden upon our movement is casualties or and attrition over time. So anything we can do to build up logistics, whether that is just as our association or by creating intentional communities, I think those are going to be extremely fruitful in retaining people and building real politic from which other electoral or other meta-political gains can flow later.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Just one quick point about fortressing. Something which is often forgotten about, in the past when we had castles and fortresses is that a fortress isn't just a defensive position. It would be entirely incorrect to think of a fort as just being a defensive position. It's people were forced to attack and siege castles for a reason, because if you tried to move past it, people from within the fort could just sally and attack your supply lines. And that's essentially what how I would see things like an autonomous Australian community in Australia looking like. It would be something which isn't just a retreat where you all just hide away and you just hope that you don't see any machete wielding youths in your area. It would be as essentially the tip of the spear, the place where the most active and involved nativists and nationalists in Australia act to push for our views from as safe of a community as you can manage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's worth tying some of these speeches together because I think actually quite a coherent vision came out from all the different speeches, which is obviously a good thing. It means that the association is pretty much on the same page. But we also had a talk on the task of nativist ideology and building up ideology and theorizing strategy and that sort of thing. And one of the things said in that was that we need to kind of think about what our victory condition is actually going to be if we're not going to be engaging in electoral politics, or at least not yet. Or if we're building up logistics and all these things, we need to sort of consider in what direction we're going. And this is definitely one of the important ones with intentional community, because there are kind of like three possible scenarios that we can go towards. We could have like some sort of electoral win, perhaps, if a party forms and gets enough votes and we get mass deportations through that. That's one sort of victory option. And then there's like the sort of vision of revolution, which, obviously we're not about at all as an association, since we operate under the law quite strictly, and we're very careful about how we engage in politics and what we do. And the last one is the sort of vision of, collapse or collapse in slow motion, which we've typically called Brazilification. And it really what we've said is that whichever route you go down, you have to build up kind of a power base in one area, because if you want to engage in electoral politics, you need to have, enough people in your seat or your state or at the smallest level in your local council in order to be able to control the political system in that area. And if we're looking at a sort of balkanization scenario, in the very long term, with the system gradually wearing down and failing under its own contradictions, as the different, I think what will happen, the different ethnic groups will stop forming one homogenous sort of anti-white force, and it'll start to fracture a lot more. We're already seeing some of those seams with, say, the Jewish community and the Palestinian issue, but also potentially the India-Pakistan thing that's heating up at the moment. So we'll see that, and obviously then the Indians and the Chinese have typically historically had a lot of antipathy towards each other. So we have all of those tensions that are waiting to sort of collapse the system if it just keeps trundling along on its course. But whichever way it goes, we have to build power in one area. So that was kind of a key takeaway that aligns, I think, with the national community concept. Sorry, intentional community.
Yeah, really well said, and it was an excellent speech. And it's a pity that many of our listeners didn't listen to it because it was very inspiring. Well done.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, so a couple of other points from that speech that we might touch on before we go to the other one of the other main ones was that we kind of mentioned this point, or the point was mentioned, that nativism is pre-ideological, which was kind of the starting point of the speech, sort of reiterating this point that sort of the fundamental idea behind nativism is, well, it's not even an idea, it's an attitude of loyalty. And loyalty to your blood, sort of that comment from the poem, right? The loaf belongs to your son, and you've been given this loaf. It's been handed down. It's a heritage, and so it's more of a spirit of loyalty to the nation, to your history, to your culture, to something that's concrete that you're just thrown into when you're born. But then, no, that was the starting point, and that's a fair place where we can critique, say, foreign ideology and so forth. But then we also need to clarify where we stand as an organization, what our strategy is, what our ideals are. And obviously we already have some things like the Charter of Principles that illustrate that, and internal documents and so forth. But the conclusion of that was that we're going to put together a kind of manifesto. So that'll be interesting to see when that comes out. But what did you guys think of that? Is ideology an important task, Grant?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just important to get the balance right as well, I think. And a lot of people spoke about that after that presentation, that we want to capture the minimum level of, I suppose, alignment on ideals and beliefs without being unnecessarily restrictive, I suppose, in terms of coming down to highly niche views on like different philosophical points of view, I suppose. Obviously, if nativism is the overall bedrock, that can be a reasonably broad tent of beliefs with a degree of flexibility, but there's obviously quite a few non-negotiables baked into that. So it'll be an interesting development to kind of flesh out, what is it a truly balanced kind of nativist position to have?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that was mentioned and people might know who gave this speech based upon this, but it was mentioned a political Platonist approach as a philosophical foundation, and the idea that we need a philosophical foundation from sort of the origins of Western culture. And we're going to try and, so, I mean, because the tree of Western culture is it's kind of dying at the moment. It's withering away, and it's being sort of poisoned by, fundamentally nihilism. It's sort of an internal problem, because I think if our spirit was up and we were fighting for our own people and our own history, we would just win. But it's because people have imbibed this sort of nihilist poison that we need the antidote to that. And it was suggested that that would be a kind of broadly Platonist approach in the spirit of, say, the Australian anti-sectarianism of the Burke Church Act. So it's kind of even broadening it beyond just sort of a Christian Platonist approach. I mean, many pagans, I suppose, would be quite sympathetic to Platonist principles as well. But in terms of the political expression, that is really, I think it aligned well with our organizational model, in that some of those ideals of Plato, like the rule of law, that he really introduced. I mean, he was basically the founder of Western political science. And his student Aristotle. But the idea of the need for the rule of law to prevent, abuse of power or arbitrary exercise of power, a mean constitution, so a median position between excesses of, an authoritarian, purely monarchical system, and on the one hand, and then a more aristocratic factor in the middle, and then like a purely democratic system. So kind of elements of each of them would be incorporated, which I think works well for us. I mean, we do implement voting, but it's voting within a already highly selective group. But what do you think of that? Are those kind of good principles? I mean, we've got epistocracy, a median constitution, and the rule of law. Grant?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and that's personally where I find myself, really. And that's also natural for the Australian position. I mean, our Commonwealth Constitution, which is, derived from the British system of law, which was then tempered in the American Constitution, and then kind of reinvigorated in a new form in our Commonwealth Constitution, I think is quite a nice balance. And obviously it needs reform to be truly healthy, but I think there's a good system in there. But honestly, as I've said many times before, regardless of what kind of system of government you have, it's only as good as the character of its people that compose the nation. So if we're to remain a totally kind of hedonistic, morally depraved people that are soulless and rootless, it doesn't matter what system of government you overlay on top, it won't work. So, all of these things, ideology and your system of government, needs to be hand in hand with a cultural renaissance and a moral revival, I suppose.
Yeah, that'd be that sort of organic, integrative, virtue-based politics that also ties in so well with the Platonist angle. I mean, we kind of, I think, at least in our early drafts, are including the transcendentals, oneness, goodness, beauty, truth, as sort of those core fundamentals of a kind of broadly Platonist position. And I think those can be instantiated in all sorts of different ways, which allows for that element of pluralism that we want. But they're non-negotiable, right? We need to have that integrative unity of the nation, the organic unity of the nation, as opposed to, this arbitrary heap of individuals that we have at the moment, where people think that you can just, switch out an Indian for an Australian, for a Chinese, and just leap, hump, or pile up all these individuals in a one big group, despite there being no sort of inner organic unity to that, and have it work out. And obviously, I think that's a recipe for disaster. But that kind of gets us to the second level down. So if that's our global one world universal principle at the top, with those transcendentals, then we have that particularism of the nativism with the next level down, the people, and then the third level down would be the geopolitics, the spatial expression of the people. As P.R. Stevenson said, you need to have both the race and the place, the spirit of the place. But that second level, the ethno-sociological level, that tied in well with a couple of other speeches. We had one on the biological basis of race and its expression in phenotypes, which was quite interesting. but then we also had a speech that kind of goes to explain why we have things like Banjo Day and Wattle Day that listeners should be familiar with. And given that that was based upon the example of Scotland, maybe you boys would like to talk about that a bit, Thomas.
I thought it was a great topic. It did focus on Scotland's Romantic revival, but it could easily be applied in Australia. So the main takeaway was that revival really begins as LARP, as kitsch, as trying too hard. It's inherently inorganic, but over time it becomes organic. It doesn't have to be, true and gritty and real. Realistic. You don't have to be talking about all the nasty, horrible things that happened throughout history. It's focusing on the good, typically. And it inspires connection to your past in healthy and in resilient ways, to the point where just people's view of history and of their own people is essentially always colored by their romantic movements. In fact, in a way, a lot of non-Western people are having like a romantic movement happen now where they're, talking about and exaggerating how wonderful their pasts were in comparison to how horrible and nasty the Westerners were. That's just my quick two cents.
Yeah, look, some of those points. I think there's a good one with the you were talking about how people sort of have a rosy view of their past, but the creation of new national sort of culture is inorganic. I think inorganic is maybe not the best word, because I think one of the key points of the presentation was that the three main people who were behind the Romantic revival, and that was one of the key points, was that it did really start with only a very small handful of people. One of those being, I think, Robert Burns, and you Scots might know the other ones. But look, despite sort of creating new things, they did, then they were doing it very intentionally, which I think is a good word. But they were rooted in folk tradition, and I think if anybody's studied nationalism as it's taught in the university, they tend to really play up this idea that that nations are constructed, and they'll say, well, it's all a class construction of the bourgeois to unify their working class to, achieve their capitalist goals or whatever. When you look carefully, you'll see that while they're being intentional and they are constructing culture, and they're doing that on a more maybe sophisticated level than the folk would. They are rooted in folk tradition. They're drawing upon folk motifs. They're not just inventing things out of whole cloth. And what makes one nation's culture authentically that culture's is that it's drawn from the folk. And for example, we had an article recently by one of our members on the Australian composer Percy, oh, not Percy, hang on. Thinking P.R. Stevenson, but that's the wrong bloke. Granger, Percy Granger, and he was one of these sort of tail end of the Romantic composers, but one of the English folk revivals. He went and collected a lot of folk music, particularly English folk music, and then set that in his band arrangements. And part of that inspired his Australian writing as well, but then he had some very particular takes on how Australian music should sound as well. So, for example, he thought that a lot of polyphony, different melodies of sort of equal value and equal importance in the piece, express a sort of Australian spirit of democratic egalitarianism, and particular scales and sets of notes that are used also reflect sort of particular ethnic traditions. I mean, you can just tell that from listening to Indian music or whatever, you know, if you happen to enter a Indian restaurant or something, I'm probably excommunicated because I know I'm given this example, but
Well, you just go to a public park, you can also
yeah,
hear
that's right. But if you've heard the Indian music there, the modes are very distinctive, and so and they wouldn't work with, say, like a Western harmony. They'd totally conflict. So yeah, it's not that things are invented out of whole cloth, but these sort of let's say high culture creators, while doing it intentionally, are drawing upon pre-existing stuff and more of the cutting edge, I think, nationalist research, which is Anthony Smith's ethno-symbolism, or even Alexander Dugin's ethno-sociology, even though I know he's a controversial character, but I think his ethno-sociology is good, apart from his rejection of biological race, which is the main cringe thing there. But both of those are very good on that point about the pre-existence of an ethnos that then informs the creation of nations. But Grant, what do you think about that speech?
Yeah, I thought it was excellent, and it was really a call to arms for all the creatives in the ANA to not be afraid of being intentional about creating new pieces of art or new bits of literature or experimenting with poetry. I mean, obviously there has been ANA slam poetry competitions in the past, but you know, shaking off the fear of being cringe or LARPy, as Tom said, but really embracing the ability to draw upon our folk culture and take it into the future by localizing it to our current time, but also being true to our unique ethno culture, I suppose. And we should really all be putting in additional effort to write short stories or poems or bits of music and really drive an intentional cultural renaissance, which will reverberate and take on its own energy over time.
Yeah, and that's really why we have these things like Banjo Day and Wattle Day. And on Banjo Day, we often do, you know, it's often a bit tongue in cheek and not too serious, a bit lighthearted. But we do some poetry competitions, and yeah, I probably won't recite my entry because it might get us removed from YouTube. But yeah, that's we can definitely do some more highbrow stuff as well off the back of that. And of course, Wattle Day to avoid not just the cultural cringe, but this idea of the biological cringe, where sort of Australians are using a lot of European metaphors and not really being embedded in our own land. And I think it's very important that we have a connection with the Australian outdoors, and that we draw
Yeah,
inspiration from
100%.
that.
I mean, this is the land that fed us, you know, like every, think about it really, like every cell that constitutes your body was derived from minerals from this very soil. You know, it has a sacred place to us, and it should truly be venerated, more than it is.
Yeah, the outdoorsmanship ties in with yet another kind of motif of or thing that was brought up, which was the idea that we need to sort of formalize and develop the ANA ranges. But the ANA ranges sort of started out as a Canberra initiative, didn't it, Grant? That's kind of
That's
our
right. Yeah,
outdoorsmanship.
it's just our hunting and camping club, really, which has been operating for years. You know, we'll periodically hunt some game animals for harvesting the meat, or we'll go hunt, camping down on the river. I mean, we have a lot of beautiful rivers and catchments in our area, and we can do a bit of handiwork while we're there, removing any weeds, you know, Scotch thistle and stuff like that. You know, we'd like to do a bit of land care and a bit of living in the bush and disconnecting from modernity. It's all a great thing to do, and great bonding opportunity and good opportunity to build your cardio endurance and go for a really long hike into the bush carrying your pack with all your food and camping equipment and all the rest of it. So, it's a good operation, the ranges.
Yeah, I think it is important to build up that element as well. Like, we don't intend to field street movement or anything at the moment, but to organize a cadre of guys who have the outdoorsmanship skills and all of that, I think if we ever need to take on that role, that can be something that might come off the back of that.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah. All right. Anything else that we want to talk about before we hit the end of this one?
No, I just think the last thing I would say is just, thanks everyone for listening, and regardless of how you feel about the last election and the immediate future politically for the nation, everyone should do a bit of soul searching and really consider what is actually within your power. What change can you really affect, and what good can you do for your fellow kinsmen, your fellow Australian, and how can you contribute regardless of the way the wind is blowing at a more national scale? I think we should really buckle down and focus on our community and our metapolitics, and become stronger and become immune, become a tree that's deeply rooted that can't easily be blown around by the wind.
Yeah, excellent. And Thomas, well, any last words from you?
Yeah, exactly right. And it's one of the best places you can go to be around other people who are sensible, intelligent, working diligently towards our future.
Yeah, on my part, again, I think the call is really, really out for everybody, all Australians, regardless of what your interests and your skills are. If you're all into business and making money, we've got ways that you can do that and help the Australian community. If your interest is, camping and outdoors and hunting and martial arts and all that sort of active stuff, then there's a place for you there where you can share your skills, or maybe even pick up some new skills from the boys who are already in. So that would be on the Rangers front. If you're more interested in ideology and you're a full theory cell, there's stuff that you can be doing. If you're an artist, again, get involved. Help us build the cultural renaissance. Help us establish this new romantic revival in Australia. Or not even, doesn't have to be romantic. Obviously, when we're talking romantic, we're looking at the sort of history of nationalism and where it came from, and the romantic movement with Herder and so forth. But yeah, we intend to fully build a post-modernity yet traditional culture in this country, and we want Australia to become a great, great civilization of world history. And I think that's fully possible if we all awaken our Australian spirit and get involved. So that's the final thing from me. But yeah, to our listeners, let us know in the comments what topics you'd like to hear about, or just leave a friendly comment like we had at the start. If there's a particular topic relating to Australia, the ANA, you'd like us to do a show on, then go ahead and ask us about that or any of the things we discussed today. And as always, I'd encourage all our supporters in the audience to make sure you like, subscribe, and share our content far and wide. We'd love to share our show with as many good Aussies as possible. And lastly, as always, if you want to reach out, you can find us at AusNatives.org. That's AusNatives.org. Signing off.